For a clearinghouse of neurology-related information on the coronavirus, go to aan.com/COVID-19 to stay up to date.
Thanks for tuning in for the April 14th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. This week's What's Trending segment features a discussion on neurology on the Hill. In the other segment, you'll hear a talk on the multiple hit theory of ALS. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the neurology podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online. It's easy and free for AAN members.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell with the Neurology Podcast, and I can hardly contain my excitement today to welcome our guest, none other than Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. Of course, Andy is a vascular neurologist and previously served as the editor of the Neurology Podcast. Andy was recently a first-time attendee to Neurology on the Hill, the annual advocacy event for the American Academy of Neurology in Washington, D.C., and Andy joins us today to discuss the event as well as the advocacy priorities for the AAN. Andy, welcome back to the podcast. It's good to talk to you.
Jason, it's great to be on the podcast as always, and great to hear from you and to be able to talk about Neurology on the Hill.
So in case some of our listeners aren't familiar with Neurology on the Hill, why don't we start with just a general overview about what this event entails?
Yeah, so Neurology on the Hill is an opportunity for members of the American Academy of Neurology to gather in Washington, D.C. This year it happened February 24th to the 25th. It's generally around that same time of the year. And meet with members of the advocacy committee for the AAN, meet with other neurologists within your state and region, and discuss legislative priorities for neurologists in practice and for the AAN. And then excitingly, be able to go up on the Hill and actually meet with your representatives from your state and local congressional district and advocate for these important legislative initiatives as it relates to the practice of neurology.
It's a lot of fun. I've been able to attend a few times myself. I saw this year that over 200 neurologists from 48 states attended to advocate for our patients. And again, if you're not familiar with this event, the advocacy priorities, the issues at stake are determined by the AAN. And so part of the experience is learning and educating yourself about the issues so that you can then meet with the lawmakers and share your perspective as a neurologist. And so why don't we go through the three issues that you guys advocated for this year at Neurology on the Hill and briefly discuss those. So the first one I saw was about improving seniors' access to care. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Andy?
Yeah, so there were a couple of initiatives that were related, and specifically regarding access to care, there is a bill currently in the House called Support the Improving Seniors Timely Access to Care Act. And the bill really seeks to decrease some of the inefficiencies in medical practice that plague us day in and day out, those of us who see patients in the clinic. Largely related to prior authorizations and interacting with insurance companies and medications to allow patients to more easily move through the clinic and, more importantly, to be able to get access to their medications and for neurologists and the folks that work in their clinics not to spend unnecessary amounts of time that are burdensome regarding administrative tasks working through some of these approvals. More specifically, the bill is trying to increase the amount of transparency and streamline prior authorization specifically for Medicare Advantage by establishing an electronic prior authorization process, minimizing the use of prior authorizations for routine approved services, ensuring those requests are reviewed by qualified medical personnel on the back end. And then there's some degree of transparency being sought from Medicare Advantage plans regarding these prior authorizations and what medications and what procedures and so forth are and aren't going to require them. And just to sort of bring this back home for our listeners who probably don't need it because we all feel it in our daily lives and practice, but on average, physicians spend about 2 days a week, either physicians or their staff, completing prior authorizations. And it often takes up to 14 days to obtain these. And as we all know, in the end, more than 90% of them are approved anyway. And so it really does seem like a needless inefficiency. And so to pull it all back down, we were advocating with our legislators up on the Hill to support this bill that's being proposed regarding timely access to care and these inefficiencies. And the good news is it does seem to be a favorable piece of legislation, obviously by us as providers and neurologists, but also, frankly, on the insurance side. who really would like to reduce some of the regulations that, from their perspective, really require these inefficiencies. So we seem to have good rapport with the folks we're speaking to regarding this piece of legislation. Hopefully it'll continue to move forward.
That's great. I think that's something, as you mentioned, that all neurologists can relate to. Just like the second issue that you all discussed, something that both providers and patients are very familiar with, which has to do with lowering out-of-pocket drug costs. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, this is a real big topic, Jason, and I will commend the podcast. You and Ted Burns and others have really brought a lot of light to drug pricing as really a plague on our healthcare system. And just to throw around a couple of numbers, if we just look at, say, medications for multiple sclerosis, average patient out-of-pocket costs have gone from $15 a month on average in 2004 to over $300 a month in 2016 and continue to skyrocket. And so what the AAN has really decided to focus on is Medicare Part D and the catastrophic coverage threshold that patients have to reach before they get additional support for their medications within Medicare Part D. And so for those who maybe tune out a little bit when we get into some of the policy wonk, just to sort of explain it a little bit, patients with Medicare Part D, they get some initial coverage for their drugs, and then they reach what's called the donut hole, and I think most folks have heard about this, where there's a coverage gap in which they essentially have to pay out of pocket until they reach a certain catastrophic coverage threshold. And that catastrophic coverage threshold is really what the legislative party is targeting. And so there are actually a couple of bills, one in the Senate and one in the House, both looking at sort of setting or reducing the limit that patients on Medicare Part D will reach that catastrophic coverage threshold. And the AAN and our jobs on Neurology on the Hill was to sort of try to push for roughly a $3,100 cap on that catastrophic coverage limit. And just to sort of give an example, currently, as of 2019, roughly around 3,000 MS patients with multiple sclerosis, for instance, would reach the current limit, which is about $5,100. But with the new House proposal and Senate proposal, many more MS patients would reach that catastrophic coverage threshold, meaning that many more of our patients would be able to get additional coverage for their drugs. And if this legislation doesn't go through, the current policy will continue to push that coverage limit way high, and more patients won't remain in that donut hole and not be able to pay for their drugs. So bottom line is, we were meeting with our legislators to try to cap that catastrophic coverage threshold and make sure more patients can have access to affordable medications, particularly our patients with neurological disease.
Yeah, regrettably, this idea of the financial toxicity of a drug is something that we as neurologists must be thinking about increasingly and should be asking our patients about as well. So I'm hopeful that there will be improvement on this front for our patients. Finally, the other issue that you all talked about on the Hill was in regards to research funding for neurological diseases. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, and Jason, this last piece of legislation seems like a no-brainer. No pun intended there, but we were really hoping that our representatives would continue to support further funding of neurologic research and specifically funding to the NIH. And this encompasses multiple different initiatives vis-a-vis the NIH. And many of the listeners may have heard about these. This includes the Brain Initiative, which is an important funding initiative through NIH to continue to fund basic science research as it relates to brain disease and advancing innovative neurotechnologies. It also includes funding for the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and to continue to support Centers for Disease Control and Surveillance, which, given our current events, obviously is an important goal of neurologists and providers everywhere to continue to support. And specifically as it relates to neurologic disease, the CDC's Neurological Condition Surveillance System, which is helping us to monitor the epidemiology of a lot of our neurological diseases as we have an aging population and a rise in prevalence of many of our diseases. So this is an important goal of ours as a community of neurologists and through the AAN to continue to support NIH funding, which will hopefully allow us to develop new treatments, new diagnostics for our patients, and fund the next generation of neurologists to fight neurologic disease. We gained a lot of support for this as well. There is a letter going around Congress supporting NIH funding, and it does seem to be a nice piece of bipartisan legislation.
Terrific. For our listeners who are interested in advocacy and maybe haven't given it too much thought in terms of how they can be involved, what are ways for them to get involved, either through the Neurology on the Hill event or otherwise?
Well, in addition to Neurology on the Hill, Jason, there are a number of other ways that neurologists can get involved with legislative issues and get involved with the AAN specifically as it relates to advocacy. There are events throughout the year, such as the Palatucci Leadership Forum, where neurologists can actually go and work with AA and staff and experts on improving their advocacy skills as it relates to talking with media and boiling down issues into simple language that they can discuss with their representatives and other lay professionals. There, as I mentioned earlier, is the advocacy committee, the AAN, for those who would more formally want to get involved and actually roll their sleeves up with some of these issues. And then the AAN really encourages all of us, if not just working through these events, but to stay in touch with our local, regional, and state representatives. For instance, there's this initiative for Neurology Off the Hill, by which neurologists might invite their local congressperson to come and visit them at their hospital or their clinic or their place of work to actually see what they do and maybe even see some of their patients with neurological disease and help bring home some of these issues related to neurology back to their legislators and those that are actually making the policy that affect us and our patients' lives.
That's great, Andy. And I'll add one to that list as well, which is the AAN Action Alert that members often see in their inbox. These are calls from the AAN advocacy team asking us as neurologists to reach out to our legislators and talk to them about a particular issue. I encourage our listeners to take advantage of those action alerts. They're really easy to do. In just a few clicks, you can let your representative know how you feel about the issue, whether it's drug pricing or prior authorization or some other advocacy issue. Finally, Andy, pull back the curtain for us. What was your favorite part of the day or something surprising or interesting or something that you'll take with you from this experience?
And Jason, there are several aspects of Neurology of the Hill, which I really enjoyed as a first-time attendee. You know, you spend the first day that you're there actually with the other folks that are attending the event, learning about how things work up on the Hill and how things work in Washington, D.C. And that may seem paradoxical to most of our listeners because oftentimes it seems like things don't work in Washington, D.C., but just sort of understanding how the sausage is made when it comes to bringing these issues that are so important to each of us, bring them actually into the legislative realm and hopefully bring some of them into law that will help us and our patients. And then I think the camaraderie with other folks from my state, from different institutions, to go up on the Hill and to spend time with them and to sort of feel like we're part of the public discourse. And so sort of that social networking that goes along with it, I think is really important as we get out of our day-to-day lives and really feel like we're contributing to something bigger than ourselves. And I'd say lastly, I was actually able to have a sit-down one-on-one conversation with my local congressman here in Virginia. And that was sort of unexpected. We didn't know if they were going to be able to meet with us in person. Frankly, based on their track record, wasn't sure if they were even going to be that interested in some of these ideas that we had, but it turns out that they were very interested, particularly as it relates to drug pricing and out-of-pocket drug costs and prior authorizations. And so it was, you know, really neat to have a down-to-earth interaction with someone in Congress and hopefully someone that will be able to help take some of these issues forward. So really a great activity, came away from it feeling inspired, exhilarated, and also more clear-minded as I go forth to do my daily job working with my patients in my own institution.
Well, Andy, thanks so much for joining us today and talking with us about the issues and your experience at Neurology on the Hill. We really appreciate your time and for telling us about how it went for you.
Thank you, Jason. I look forward to continuing to practice neurology, not on the Hill, but down in the Valley, and hopeful opportunity to participate again in the future.
Thanks, Andy.
Hi, everyone. This is Matthew Harms, a neurologist and geneticist at the Eleanor and Lou Gehrig ALS Center at Columbia University. Today, I have the opportunity to interview clinician scientist Steve Buchik, professor of neurology at the Westmead Clinical School at the University of Sydney, Australia. Today, we're going to discuss his paper, published recently in Neurology, entitled ALS is a Multi-Step Process in South Korean, Japanese, and Australian Patients. So Steve, one of the great revolutions that's been taking place has to do with sequencing technologies that have gotten simpler and cheaper and employed over the last decade for diseases like ALS. And that's given us a lot of understanding and advances in understanding the genetic architecture of things like ALS. Can you briefly review for us those advances and how they've taught us about the genetic landscape of ALS?
Thank you very much. Yes, there's been tremendous advances in the sequencing techniques, and you've rightly pointed out that these have become simpler and more widely applicable. They've really transformed our understanding of neurodegenerative diseases like ALS or motor neuron disease. One of the major discoveries has been the C9orf gene, which was published in 2011, which really transformed our understanding of ALS in that it really put it into the realms of brain disorders or dementias, and there'd been a lot of argument about this prior to that. Now, in terms of our pathophysiological understanding, what we do understand is that there are a number of genes that are implicated in ALS, both predisposition, but also in the governing of its rate of disease progression and the phenotype. And what is also quite exciting is that these genetic abnormalities have now become a focus for therapeutic intervention through various genetic therapies, including DNA surgeries, antisense oligonucleotide technologies, and so on. So I think the sequencing technologies have really transformed our understanding of ALS. And so what that tells us is that the predisposition to develop ALS is there from birth, but that the pathophysiologies that trigger ALS are quite complex.
Yeah, you know, every patients are asking, was there something about my lifestyle? Was there something about my background where I grew up that might have triggered ALS? And in particular, if they have sporadic disease that comes up.
ALS is an extremely complex disease. And as I mentioned, there is a tight interaction between, I believe, genetic, epigenetic, molecular, and environmental factors, which trigger or govern sort of the onset of ALS, but also regulate its rate of disease progression and its phenotype. Over the last decade or so, there's certainly been a number of environmental factors that have impacted on ALS. For example, we now understand that it seems to be more common in athletes, for example, in marathon runners and other types of demanding sports. We also know that it's more common in certain occupations, such as the military. So clearly, there is a predisposition in these patients who develop ALS. What I think is the critical question is how these factors interact. It is also quite fascinating that there is an immense amount of heterogeneity in ALS, both in the phenotype, but also in rate of disease progression. What we haven't been able to understand is why certain patients have bulbar onset disease compared to limb onset disease, and still we're also less able to understand about the various phenotypes. So you wonder whether there is something in the environment and the way that it interacts with the genes that predispose you to have this particular phenotype. I think we have to also be very careful when speaking with patients, especially those patients that have apparently sporadic forms of ALS, that we don't frighten them with regards to the genes. So these are not monogenic conditions. These are not like your typical genetic conditions that we got taught in medical school. That is, if your father or your mother has it, you have a 1 in 4 or 1 in 2 chance of getting this. No, I think this is far more complex, and it is clearly a polygenetic disorder. And what I think we have to sort of say to the patients in a clinical setting is that, yes, there are certain lifestyle choices that will predispose you to ALS. However, this is not a certainty.
That brings me around to your very fascinating paper, where maybe not being able to establish causal links between different exposures or genes and sorting all that out, but really taking a step back to the step just before that, which is to say, kind of on average, how many steps or insults are needed to bring about or cause a phenotypic manifestation of ALS. So would you mind just catching us up on the statistical method that you employed in your study and exactly what it's designed to tell us about the disease?
Well, we employed the cancer models that were used in the 50s, the Armitage and Dole model, whereby they expressed the incidence of an event versus the incidence of the time that event occurred. And in the original cancer papers, they reported a multi-step process. And we were always fascinated by this. And then there was another manuscript that came out some years ago in a European cohort, which suggested that there may be a linear relationship between the event, that is the incidence of ALS, versus the age of onset, when both were expressed on logarithmic scales. Now, linear process would suggest a multi-step event, and the slope of that curve will give you the number of steps that are required to develop a particular event, in this case, the onset of ALS. So this was, to us, a very simple way of expressing, or rather of determining, whether ALS indeed was a disease that just starts at the time of your symptoms, or whether it is more sinister, and are there steps in the preclinical phase or period that perhaps predispose you to developing ALS and lead you to develop ALS at a certain point in your life. So this is a very simple model that is quite powerful in its interpretations and in the results that it gives.
So that model, you used it in 3 different populations. one from Australia, one from Japan, and one from Korea. And what did you find?
In collaboration with my colleagues from Japan and South Korea, whom I'm very grateful to, we obtained the necessary data to conduct this research. And we sort of expected these findings, but it was nice to kind of show them that ALS was a multi-step process, irrespective of your ethnic background. And what was more fascinating is that you required 5 or 6 steps, depending on which population you came from. Specifically in the Australian and the Japanese ALS patients, 6 steps were required, whilst for the South Korean population, 5 steps were required. So that tells us that the pathogenesis or the road to develop ALS is very similar. You still need 5 to 6 steps. It is a multi-step process.
So as I'm kind of thinking of the neuron like a pinata, and it's stuffed with cytoplasma and mitochondria and all those types of things instead of candy, but neuron bursts open metaphorically, that's kind of when ALS begins. And so are you essentially saying that basically people or adults kind of across the lifespan are striking the neuron, and at some point it just can't keep up and develops ALS? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely. I think that's a wonderful analogy, the pinata one. I completely agree with that. I think once we start seeing the patients, I think there is already a lot of damage that's been done at a molecular level. And so there are a number of factors in utero to your birth and so on as you're growing up. And as you're growing up, you're accumulating these various hits to the genetic and also to the molecular pathways. And it would explain why ALS at a molecular level is so complex. The mitochondria, there's also oxidative stress and stress granules that are affected, protein precipitations, and so on. One of the factors that we've been also focusing on is this issue of cortical hyperexcitability. This is just a theory, but I suspect that these hits really start in utero from your genetic inheritance, but also through various environmental factors in utero, then in your early childhood, and so on through to your adulthood. And a point in time comes where the nervous system can no longer compensate for what is occurring. And that's when we get the spinal and bulbar motor neurons and other motor neurons, I might say.
Right. So this multi-step process also applies even in people who are carrying so-called pathogenic mutations, right? So a C9 mutation could actually be strong enough of an insult or a hit to the pinata that you would only need a couple of additional factors, whereas somebody with no genetic mutations and known ALS genes might need, you know, the full 6. Is there evidence for that?
No, absolutely. And there was a paper that was recently published by the European group, and I believe published in Neurology, that looked at that very fact. They looked at the 3 common mutations or genetic abnormalities they had in the European populations, the C9orf, the SOD1, and the TDP43. And what they found was that the number of steps required were less. But nonetheless, they were not 0. You still needed additional steps. For example, if you had the C9orf gene, you needed 2 steps. If you had the SOD1, you needed 3, and TDP43, you needed 4 steps, compared to, say, 6 steps for sporadic ALS. So you're right. A known genetic insult represents a lot more steps than, say, if you have sporadic ALS. But nonetheless, you still need those additional factors to trigger the disease. So what we know is that the genes are not enough to trigger the disease. You know, a certain percentage of patients with C9orf expansions never develop ALS. So there are additional factors, but the genes are a very important step. I completely agree with that.
Great. Well, one of the last things that I found exciting about your paper is that most of what we know about ALS and its genetics comes from the study of European and North American populations. And here, your study is relying on Korea and Japan, and there are emerging studies from Indian populations and from Turkey and Brazil and other places around the world, which is really great to see. What are these genetic studies of ALS happening outside of Caucasian European populations telling us about the disease, and what can we anticipate learning from them in the future?
Look, I think these studies are absolutely important. We know that there are differences in the genetics between the European and, say, the Asian populations. We know that different genes predispose to ALS. For example, C9orf, the hexanucleotide expansion, is extremely rare in the South Korean and Japanese populations. So I think it will give us a better idea on the role of genetics, rather than the genes will play in the disease. The other thing that will also be of tremendous interest is the role of the environment and also the role of lifestyle. How these factors affect ALS. One thing that I've been fascinated about is that ALS is hardly ever seen in the indigenous populations. I don't know of a case of an Australian Aboriginal person that has ALS. So that has always fascinated me. Why is this the case? there has been mixing of the populations over the last 100 or so years in Australia, yet I've never seen a case of ALS in the Aboriginal population. So it's clearly the environmental and lifestyle factors that impact on this. So studying patients from Japan and South Korea, but also from other Southeast Asian nations and China and the other nations that you mentioned, I think is absolutely crucial to our gaining a better understanding of what triggers the disease and also what governs it. The ultimate aim is to try and identify mechanisms that can slow down or even stop this disorder.
Great. This is Matt Harms again, and I've had the opportunity to talk with Steve Vucic from Australia about his paper recently published in Neurology titled ALS is a Multi-Step Process in South Korean, Japanese, and Australian Patients. Steve, thank you very much for enlightening us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on how better stress coping is associated with lower tau levels in amyloid-positive, cognitively unimpaired older adults, and another article on a population-based analysis of survival in patients with spinal muscular atrophy. Please take a look at this and other articles this week. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.